Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Every part of this process, from passing two very carefully crafted bills in the Finance Committee and the Health Committee into one comprehensive bill to reaching final consensus, has been, it's fair to say, an enormous undertaking.
An enormous undertaking indeed, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And it does look like history is about to be made with the biggest step toward universal health insurance in America since Medicare and Medicaid. And as you've no doubt heard all weekend, if you've heard any news at all 60 Democrats are now on board for a version of health care reform. The first procedural test came this morning, and it did get the needed 60 votes. And by the way, all 40 Republicans voted no. So we will spend some time to begin our show today slowing down the news wheel a little bit to take a good look at some of the major new provisions in this version of the bill with Princeton University professor Paul Starr, who's been helping out on this several times over the last month. He was a major health policy advisor to President Clinton during that health reform process, and he's the author of the classic book called The Social Transformation of American Medicine. So, Professor Starr, thank you for coming back on and helping us again to understand what's going on.
Good to be with you, Brian.
And listeners, our phones and webpage are open for your questions about the Senate bill. We can take your opinions, too. But this segment right now is mostly to explain the details. That's so much of what our mission is, and we're going to slow it down and try to do it in some detail right now. So questions and clarifications will get first priority. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to call up, 212-433-9692, or post an opinion, certainly welcome there, to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So, Professor Starr, this version has no public option, but it would establish two new private health insurance plans to enter the market nationally. Now, health insurance is sold today on a state-by-state basis, so that would be different. And one of these new plans, as I understand it, would need to be nonprofit. So can you explain what's new there, and why is it significant that these plans would be offered nationally?
Well, I think the effort here is to bring more competition into some of the states where at this point there is one dominant or two dominant insurers. And so I think in the absence of a public option, what the Senate is trying to do here, what the Democrats in the Senate are trying to do here, is to use federal authority. This will be done through the Office of Personnel Management that runs the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, which is a very successful smaller version of the reform that's being undertaken. And so to use that authority to negotiate these health plans that will be accessible all over.
By way of background, why are there no national health plans as it is? I mean, conservatives who have long argued for more deregulation of the healthcare market say health insurance companies should always have been allowed to compete across state lines, which makes common sense to me if you're interested in competition, trying to hold down price and increase quality. Why hasn't that been the case?
Well, large companies have been able to escape from state regulation. That is, large nationwide companies have been able to escape through provision of a law known as ERISA. And otherwise, small businesses and individuals have to buy insurance that's regulated by each individual state. And so I think the pressure for national regulation was reduced by the fact that the big companies had an escape clause.
And I read that the Congressional Budget Office says there will be no difference in the number of people covered under this system and who would have been covered under the actual public option that was in the previous version of the Senate bill. Does this make sense to you?
Yes, because the public option that was in the previous version was already of very minor significance. It was only going to cover about 2% of the overall population in the country. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimated that it would have higher premiums than private insurers. So really, I mean, at this point, the public option was not a significant loss to the bill. This is really a very major reform. It may be the most underappreciated social reform in my lifetime. It is going to completely transform the way health insurance is bought and sold in the United States. There's a whole new system of rules, a much better system of rules, as well as new provisions that will put health insurance within the reach of millions of people who can't afford it now.
What do you expect to be the difference between the for-profit national plan and the not-for-profit national plan, since the bill would require at least one be nonprofit, in terms of quality and price?
I don't really think, you know, that is necessarily going to be all that significant. I do think if we're, let me be careful about this. I do think there is a difference between the nonprofit and for-profit HMOs. Some of the older nonprofit HMOs have a much better record in quality of care than do the for-profit HMOs. But if we're talking about more conventional forms of health insurance, the difference between a nonprofit Blue Cross plan and some of the for-profit insurers, I don't really think is all that significant.
And that's interesting to me, because one of the liberal assumptions in the entire health reform debate is that health insurance is so expensive and denials of claims are so rampant because for-profit insurance companies are trying to maximize profits all the time. Is that a fiction, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's not a fiction that there are real problems with health insurance. I think they extend across the board to nonprofit as well as for-profit insurance, and they have to do not with the people who are running the companies or with their whether they're motivated by profit or not. It has to do with the rules of the health insurance system. I think this is what's so hard to understand. If you go back historically, and this is something I've studied for many, many years, if you go back to the 1930s and 40s when health insurance was first developing, and it was developing then on a nonprofit basis by Blue Cross, health insurance plans then offered what's called community rating. It offered the same price for a premium to everybody. And then commercial insurers came in, and they started offering better prices to healthier people and to employers with younger workers. And over time, Blue Cross had to adjust to the realities of that competition and to move closer to the practices of the commercial insurers. And that changed the way the entire marketplace worked. What this bill is trying to do, in a way, is to move us back toward the earlier system, a system which had what we call community rating, and that's going to be one of the aspects of this reform. It's not what's called pure community rating. There is going to be some allowance for differences according to age, and there also is a provision to allow insurers to charge more to smokers than non-smokers. But other than that, insurers will no longer be able to charge more to people who have chronic illnesses. They won't be able to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions. They will be required to issue a policy. They can't say no. These are enormous changes in the way health insurance works. There won't be lifetime or annual limits. There's going to be a whole new method for people to buy insurance if they now buy it individually or through very small employers. And that is going to give them this new method, the health insurance exchanges, is going to give them a lot more buying leverage in the marketplace. This is going to put health insurance within reach, again, of millions of people who don't have it now.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we look at the details of the emerging Senate health care bill, which did get 60 votes this morning in its first test, so it looks like this will pass before Christmas, and then it'll go to a conference committee to reconcile differences with the House bill. But something is now going to get passed in terms of historic health reform, and Princeton University professor Paul Starr is helping us understand what's here. He was a health policy advisor to President Clinton during that reform process, and he is author of the classic book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine. And while we're on the question of for-profit and not-for-profit, Robert in Marine Park has, I think, a relevant question. Robert, you're on WNYC.
Oh, thank you. Hello, Professor Starr. I'm confused. Bob Schieffer said yesterday on Face the Nation that the healthcare exchanges includes nonprofit co-ops. when Empire Blue Cross was nonprofit about more than 10 years ago, my premiums did not go up for 12 years. And since it's been for profit, my premiums went up 70%. Would not I benefit from these nonprofit co-ops?
Okay, so the nonprofit co-ops are an idea that was introduced by the Senate Finance Committee as an alternative to the government health plan, the public option. And, I think it's a good experiment that the bill includes this provision for nonprofit co-ops. Historically, co-ops have had a very small role in health insurance.
And just to be clear, when we're talking about nonprofit co-ops now, this is different than the nonprofit national health insurance
yes.
plan that we were just discussing?
Yes, these would be plans that would be owned by their members, by their subscribers. And there are such co-ops that do exist, and the most successful is the Group Health Cooperative of Puget Sound in Seattle, which is a healthcare cooperative. The members own the healthcare system. It's not just insurance. It owns its own facilities and employs its own doctors and so forth. And it's by far the most successful. We don't have a lot of other examples of it, but I think it's a great thing that there is money to support that.
All right. Now, Nick in Cliffside Park wants to challenge your assertion that they get close to community rating with just a little more if you're an older buyer of insurance. Nick, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, I mean, your guest just said, he used the words, it's a little bit more if you're older. Well, the figure I hear is that it's 300% more if you're older, and I think this bill is a boondoggle for the insurance industry. I think that you're acting as a sales rep for that industry and promoting this bill, which isn't going to get past the House anyway.
I should say, it's certainly not Paul Starr's history or reputation to act as a salesman for the insurance industry. But Nick asked a factual question. Is it not 300% more for older buyers of insurance on the new private market than for younger ones?
Well, this is really a complicated question, and it has nothing to do with the interests of the insurance company. The question is, how much more are you going to let insurers charge older than younger people? And the problem here, of course, is that if you don't let them charge any more for older people, they're going to have to charge more for younger people. And one of the big problems we have is convincing young people, people in their 20s, to buy insurance, because a lot of them think they're immortal. They're never going to need it. And so the price can't be seen to be so unreasonable for them. And so it's a tough question as to what ratio as to allow. In the present market, it's more like 10 to 1. So this is going to compress the differences a lot. And what you really have to stand, what the caller has to understand, is that this bill caps the amount of money that subscribers, that people have to pay for insurance according to their income. And so those older people, that is people below age 65, let's say between 55 and 65, if their incomes are within four times the poverty level, okay, and the poverty level for a family of four is about 20,000, and so we're talking about now families with up to 40,000, up to 80,000 in income, they're going to have affordability subsidies that will limit how much they have to pay. So even though there's a 3-to-1 ratio there from older to younger, there is a limit on how much those older people, as well as the younger people, will have to pay for insurance.
And Professor Starr, let me stay on the whole topic of the insurance companies for another couple of questions, because there are a few other things going on here that I find very interesting. One is, I heard over the weekend that insurance industry stocks, health insurance industry stocks, hit a 52-week high on Friday in anticipation of this deal. And we're starting to look up this morning's trading, and it looks on first blush like Aetna is up maybe as much as 6%. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I don't know what else is driving the stock market now. It is true that they will have an expanded market, because we're going to be covering now 30 million people who weren't covered before, and there's going to be federal money to subsidize the purchase of insurance. So, yes, I suppose that's good for them. Actually, the Health Insurance Association of America has been saying a lot of negative things about this legislation. There are a lot of provisions they don't like.
And we'll try to get closer to that maybe later in the week with another guest. We'll get close to Wall Street and figure out the real health insurance industry reaction as reflected by the stock price. But
let me mention another aspect of this whole thing right now. It's very likely that the larger insurance companies will benefit at the expense of smaller insurance companies. So I think that may be a lot of what's going on with those stocks.
Why would that be?
Because many of the smaller insurance companies engage in what's called cherry picking. They are in business with very limited policies that they aim at only at healthy people. They exclude everybody else. They're not going to be able to do that anymore in this marketplace. And this market is probably going to work in favor of the bigger companies that can spread their risks more than the smaller ones.
Which brings me to another provision of the bill. Insurance companies would have to spend 80% of their premium revenue on medical care for individual policies, 85% of what they take in premiums for group policies. What would that mean, and how different is that from current percentages?
Yeah, so that is a big change, which really cuts against the assumptions, I think, of the caller and many other people, that this is all for the benefit of the insurance companies, because right now the figures are very different. In the individual market, only about 60 cents out of every dollar that people pay for premiums goes for medical care. So this is now going to require that the insurance companies devote a higher percentage of the premium dollar to actual medical expenses. And that will cut into their administrative costs. It will cut into their profits. I think, again, this is particularly going to affect the smaller companies rather than the bigger ones.
Healthcare expert Paul Starr with us on WNYC explaining the Senate bill, which passed its first 60-vote test this morning. You were talking about the subsidies that individuals would get. Small employers would also get some of these subsidies to help them cover their workers. And Wesley in Brooklyn has a question about that. Wesley, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing? So I just want to understand what's wrong with the scenario I'm about to give you. So the sanctions against employers for dropping coverage are not very high. So from December 31st to January 1st, I'm assuming a lot of people will drop coverage. So a whole bunch of lower middle class people are going to experience this bill as suddenly owing several thousand dollars they didn't owe the year before. And to me, it's going to just be a populist there's going to be such an outcry against it, because essentially it'll seem like their pockets are being picked for something that they didn't have to pay for the year before. What is wrong with that? Well, why am I wrong in assuming that?
Okay, good question. That doesn't actually kick in for a few years. So it's not like between today and January 1st, employers are going to do anything, because it's a few years from now that these sanctions on employers for not covering their workers would even take effect. But Paul Starr, why is he wrong that when it does take effect, there'll be a rush to the exits on the part of employers? They'll pay the fine, which is, at least especially in the Senate bill, not that big, and then let their workers go fend for themselves on these insurance exchanges.
Well, there are incentives. There are tax credits for small employers. And I have not actually seen the text of the very final bill, but looking at the Senate leadership bill, I have some provisions up in front of me. And the tax credits for small employers begin actually in 2011. So they begin earlier than the rest of the system. I think this is aimed at trying to encourage employers to provide coverage in the intervening years rather than drop it. I don't deny that there may be some of what the caller is talking about. I think there are other provisions in the bill that should help counteract it.
And one big difference, keep your eye on this, one big difference between the Senate bill and the House bill that they'll have to reconcile when it goes to a conference committee is what the sanctions on employers are. Tell me if you agree, Professor Starr, that this is a big, big difference, because the House bill would fine employers 8% of payroll for each worker that they didn't cover. That's a lot. That's relatively the same as covering most workers with a health insurance plan. In the Senate bill, it's only a $750 fine for each full-time worker, which would be thousands of dollars less than the House bill, and certainly thousands of dollars less than the typical insurance policy cost, just $750. So that's a big difference, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And look, there are a whole series of provisions on which the House bill is much stronger. And I hope that the House prevails on many of these things.
And we will take a break on that note and come back and talk about some more. There's so many interesting provisions of this bill as it emerged over the last few days. We'll talk about something else that's brand new in the bill, long-term care insurance that would be available to many, many Americans, something a lot of people want and don't actually go out and buy. We'll also, for Paul Starr, who, as you hear, is largely a supporter of this approach, we will tick off some of the objections in the Wall Street Journal lead editorial today and see what he thinks about it. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
There's no bipartisanship here. There's no negotiations. There's no conversation. And no one knows what's in this bill but one senator. One senator knows what's in this bill.
Maybe the other should read it. That was Senator John McCain referring to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who put this majority leader's version of the bill out to the floor over the weekend after getting Ben Nelson from Nebraska to agree to it. Nebraska gets quite a couple of sweeteners here, which we'll go over. But we are slowing down the news wheel here and looking at the details of this Senate health reform bill, which did get the 60 votes needed to stave off a Republican filibuster in its first test this morning. There will be a series of votes between now and Thursday, probably. And then I guess after New Year's, they'll have to reconcile it with the House bill. But it now seems all but certain that some kind of historic health reform will be passed by this Congress and this president. And we're looking at details with Princeton University Professor Paul Starr, who was a top health policy advisor to President Clinton during that reform process and is author of the classic book called The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Professor,
Brian, can I say something about bipartisanship?
Sure. Okay. You want to wade into those waters now. Sure?
I do. On the Senate Finance Committee, for months, there were efforts to create a bipartisan compromise with Senator Grassley and with Senator Snow. And Senator Snow did vote for the Senate Finance Bill in the end. Months were used up trying to work out a deal with them. It looks really, in retrospect, that Senator Grassley was just stringing the Democrats along. I don't think that of Senator Snow, but I do think that of some of the others. And the whole idea that this is being done in a rush is really ridiculous. This effort, after all, has been going on now for the better part of a year. And the Republicans have been stonewalling, have been just trying to stop it at every turn without any constructive alternatives whatsoever.
And what about Olympia Snow? What do you make of her? Because, you know, I thought her big demand was to get the public option out, and it's out.
Yes. She should be satisfied. It is possible that they'll get her vote for the final reconciliation bill. I doubt it. I think basically she's lined up with her colleagues. They were probably very upset with her. You know, in a longer historical perspective, this is really a bipartisan bill. If you look back to the earlier decades when there were debates over health insurance, back to the Truman era, back to the 1970s, many Republicans put forward proposals in those days for the government to subsidize private insurance. At that time, Democrats were calling for what is now known as a single-payer plan. That was the Truman proposal. That's what Ted Kennedy favored in the 1960s and 70s.
Right.
And this was the Republican alternative. Actually, what Democrats are moving ahead with now is much closer to what Republicans favored in the past. So this is a bipartisan compromise. It's just a bipartisan compromise with an old Republican Party that no longer exists.
That no longer exists. I think that's an astute political point, because if you look at what this actually is, the way the ground has shifted in this country, what used to be moderate Republicans don't really exist very much anymore. Yes, there's Susan Collins and Olympia Snow and a couple of others, but there's not a block like there used to be. And some of the Democrats that are being elected, especially in the sweeps in 2006 and 2008, both in the House and the Senate, are more conservative than Democrats may have been in the past. So with this polarization, it just so happens to be the Democrats that are sort of the moderate party right now, as well as having their very strong liberal wing. There isn't as much of a moderate block in the Republican Party. So if you take the party labels off of it and look at it in terms of right to left, then you have this big sort of center to left of center coalition behind this bill. And it is 60 votes in the Senate. That's because you have to have 60 there to stop a filibuster. This is not 51 to 49 in typical narrow partisan terms. It's 60 to 40. So if that's seen as representing the population since these people were elected, that's a big majority. So, all right.
Yes, I mean, I think there were a lot of moderates who in years past, 30 years ago, would have been in the Republican Party. They don't feel comfortable there anymore. They've become Democrats. Some of them are now in the Senate. So in effect, you have a kind of bipartisanship in one party.
And another political dynamic to acknowledge, I don't want to dwell on it, and we certainly won't solve it today because it's a matter of speculation. The idea of Obamacare health reform has become less and less popular as the debate has gone on. I think that's often to be expected. At the moment, it's in a slight negative around the country in the polls. And so, there's a debate now breaking out among Democrats and Republicans as to whether this is going to become more popular over time as it actually takes effect and people realize what benefits are in it for them, or it's going to become less popular over time as it takes effect and people see what a Rube Goldberg monstrosity is and how it taxes them and limits their choices and so forth more in the fine print. So that's for history or the future, really, to determine. But that's part of the political debate that pundits are having right now. So kind of along those lines, let me toss at you, Paul Starr, some of the objections to this bill and contrary analyses that are on the Wall Street Journal editorial page today. And they devote their entire editorial section to denouncing this bill. All right. So here's one of the specifics on premiums. The Wall Street Journal says the best and most rigorous cost analysis was recently released by the insurer, WellPoint, which mined its actuarial data in various regional markets to model the Senate bill. WellPoint found that a healthy 25-year-old in Milwaukee buying coverage on the individual market will see his costs rise by 178%. A small business based in Richmond with 8 employees in average health will see a 23% increase in premiums. Insurance costs for a 40-year-old family with 2 kids living in Indianapolis will pay 106% more, and so on. And here's why it says. It says these increases are solely the result of Obamacare, above and far beyond the status quo, because its strict restrictions on underwriting and risk pooling would distort insurance markets. Your reaction?
The Congressional Budget Office did an analysis and found virtually no impact on the premiums that people will pay. And the reason is, well, some will go up and some will go down. The Wall Street Journal has perhaps picked out those which will go up, naturally, hasn't focused on the ones that will go down. You can't write legislation without having mixed effects. Look, we're going to be bringing more than 30 million people into the system, providing them health insurance coverage, protecting them from bankruptcy when they get sick.
Indeed. But what it sounds like this doesn't do is solve the main problem that people who have insurance are constantly complaining about, which is that premiums are going up and up every year, that deductibles and copays are going up every year, that we're being nickeled and dimed and really $10 and $50 to death by the insurance companies, by insurance and health inflation right now. It sounds like this actually does nothing for the mass of people who are insured currently, mostly by their employers, and are watching this inflation run ahead in the private sector. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. People who buy insurance individually and people who buy insurance through very small employers are getting a rotten deal in the insurance market today. I mentioned before, if you're an individual who buys insurance, about 60 cents out of every dollar goes to pay for health care. And that's because the individual insurance market is so phenomenally inefficient. The brokers, the medical underwriting practices that the Wall Street Journal is referring to, which involves pricing policies differently for people according to their health, according to various other characteristics, all that adds tremendously to the overhead, and that's going to be largely eliminated in the new system. Those people are going to get more for their dollar in health care coverage. So they are going to be better off. It is true that this will not affect millions of people who now get their coverage through large employers. There was a lot of concern that a lot of those people like the coverage they have now, and that that if the reforms proposed to change all of that at once, there'd be a lot of resistance.
And similarly, the Wall Street Journal editorial page says, unnoticed by the press corps on the issue of choice, the Congressional Budget Office argued recently that the Senate bill would quoting this Congressional Budget Office, substantially reduce flexibility in terms of the types, prices, and number of private sellers of health insurance, unquote, that companies like WellPoint might need to be considered part of the federal budget. Reaction to that?
Well, I don't think that's right. Let's think about this whole question of choice. Many people today who get their coverage through a small employer have no choice whatsoever. Typically, there's just one plan, one option for them. The health insurance exchanges will expand the number of choices they have very considerably. Choices as to the extent of coverage, choices as to the insurer. I think they're going to be very happy having that expanded range of choice. And what many of us hope is that those insurance exchanges become a model and that more employers come into that system in the future. And as a result, the decision about insurance will increasingly move from the employer to the individual employee and his or her family.
All right. We're almost out of time with Paul Starr, Princeton professor who was there at the creation of the Clinton health reform as a top policy advisor at that time and is author of the classic book called The Social Transformation of American Medicine. I want to get to a couple of other things real quick, and then, listeners, we will keep talking about this and keep digging into this historic bill, what you like about it, what you don't like about it, a lot more details all week long. Something else that's brand new in the bill that I really want to mention, long-term care insurance, Professor Starr, for care in your home, something many Americans want in case they become seriously disabled so they don't have to go to nursing homes or send our loved ones there. Can you explain how this would work in a federal bill and what it would actually provide?
This is called the CLASS Act, the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Act. And I have not read the very final provision, so I want to be careful about this. Mm-hmm. It may have been changed. There were negotiations going on about this. These are this is a program that would pay enrollees $50 more per day if they became too disabled to perform daily activities. So it's money that can go to support home care. It is money that can go to support nursing home care. But the important thing about this is that it really would enable millions of people now who have who now end up going into nursing homes because that's where they can get Medicaid coverage. It would enable them to stay in their own homes. And so I think it would make a huge difference in their lives.
And $50 a day won't usually do it, but it's a contribution.
Yes.
Toward staying in your home and paying for that home care. So before you go, and I really appreciate you coming on with us three times in short order over a few week period and adding your historical knowledge and deep expertise in this area, your classic book is The Social Transformation of American Medicine. How does this health reform continue or alter the direction of the social transformation of American medicine, including the practice of medicine, as you have been observing it since the 1980s?
This has been such a long and difficult struggle in the United States, going all the way back to the period just before World War I. So many efforts have been made. So many have failed. It is extraordinary that we may be on the verge, finally, of enacting a reform that I think will bring us very close to universal coverage, not quite get us all the way there, but get us very close to universal coverage, that will eliminate some of the worst abuses in the insurance market, that will begin to correct the flaws in the system that have generated such high costs. It doesn't do everything that's necessary, but I think it really sets in motion a lot of important experiments, a lot of important measures that I think will begin to slow down that rate of growth in healthcare costs. I think it's going to make a huge difference. It's, as I said, it's the culmination of a long, long struggle.
Will doctors run away from Medicare with these big cuts that are coming?
I don't think so. There are places in the country, one of your callers that was on last time talked about this, there are places where some doctors, in some cases a lot of doctors, don't take Medicare. But that's not generally a problem throughout the country as a whole, and I don't think it will be now.
All right, and we will continue on that question as the week goes on and continue to look into aspects of the health care bill. Princeton University Professor Paul Starr, author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine, thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And still to come today, we will dig into the details of the other historic agreement that President Obama reached over the weekend, and that is the Copenhagen Climate Change Accord. So much negativity about that, and a lot of it deserved, but that also does some things. So we will look closely at that with Jeffrey Sachs. And coming up in a minute, we will follow up with another one of you who posted during the year to our Uncommon Economic Indicators Project and take one more round of your phone calls with your Uncommon Economic New Year's resolutions. Stay with us.